Hi, welcome back to the 9 till noon show with Michaela Clark in for Greg Hughes this morning. We were talking earlier about ambulance staff now being told not to bring their work vehicles home until a dispute over a benefit in kind has been resolved. Well, we have been contacted by Councillor Joy Baird. She's supporting a campaign to stop the removal of the ambulance vehicles being taken home by staff. She has sent us in a WhatsApp message and here is what she had to say.
Good morning, Michaela. It's Councillor Joy Baird. I really couldn't believe what I was hearing when I heard that they were considering this to be a benefit in kind to these heroes in our, absolute heroes in our communities, that bring the ambulances home from work in the event that someone does need emergency assistance. To have that taken away in our rural communities, it beggars belief, I'll be honest. It just beggars belief that it even would be considered. As I said, these people do this voluntarily. It's a valuable, valuable resource in our communities. It's life-saving. And it's absolutely ridiculous that anyone would think this is acceptable. Common sense must prevail in this instance. And I would like to support any campaign to get the ambulance to be allowed to be brought home the way they have been for many years. And I'd just like to thank those ambulance personnel for the tireless work that they have been doing on a voluntary basis when they get home from their full day's work. It beggars belief who thought this was a good idea. And I too will be writing to the Health Minister and the Finance Minister to stress my concerns about this being removed from our rural communities. It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, I do think it's going to leave a lot of communities in fear. Now, another listener says, you don't see the guards or firemen taking their work vehicles home with them. Another says, the current government seem determined to attack the people of Donegal via the healthcare system. This seems to be a common avenue of attack used on the people of Donegal by the political establishment in recent years. We actually have many Donegal TDs in Dublin, but it's not helping. This would indicate there is no political solution to the Donegal healthcare problem. Another person says it's an absolute disgrace that we're losing our ambulance response vehicle. Lives will be lost due to this change. John Joe McGowan is such an important person in our area. We must, as a community, fight for this service to be kept. Well done to Debbie is the message for highlighting this. So yeah, Debbie has said that she will possibly organise a public meeting if there's no U-turn on this. Another health issue we were discussing was attacks on security staff. A very concerning one because it begs the question if people are attacking security personnel at the hospital, you know, who is next if, you know, they can't deter them? So comment in says, not enough security in Letterkenny Hospital. Sligo have more. There should be an audit done in Letterkenny and Sligo to compare the staff. For far too long, this issue was ignored by hospital management. Security is seen to be isolated within the hospital system. They forget that they have a duty and care to security in the hospital as they are hospital staff as well. And another listener says, Sligo have 4 security guards per shift. Letterkenny only have 2. We were talking to Councillor Jeremy McMonagle on this before the news at 10, and the HSE has given us a response. They say, while we cannot comment on issues concerning individual staff matters, any allegations regarding mistreatment of staff are taken extremely seriously by Letterkenny University Hospital. A priority concern for us in LUH is to ensure the safety of our employees and service users. LUH adheres to the HSE policy on the prevention and management of work-related aggression and violence, which is published on the HSE website. This policy outlines the HSE commitment to creating a safe environment within which to work or to be treated. LUH security team includes a number of multitask attendants who complete roles within the porturing department and the security department as required by this service. All LUH security personnel, including MTAs, have completed training in prevention and management of aggression and violence. So that's what Councillor McMonagle was discussing as well. While they say that they're using porter staff, they also have other duties. And if an incident breaks out and additional personnel are required, you know, they could be minutes away. They could be up to maybe 15 minutes away, tied up dealing with another issue. So, yeah, it's obviously something that does need to be addressed. And do we need more or does there need to be a greater clampdown on attacks on security staff at hospitals? Let us know on 0866 6025000. You can text or WhatsApp that number or call us on 0749125000 or also email comments at highlandradio.com. Now, welcome back to the 9 till noon show. A couple more comments. The Gardaí should take away those causing incidents at the hospital to a padded cell until they are sobered up. The hospital is not the place for drunk people or those under the influence of drugs. That's what I was asking earlier as well. It is a very difficult situation, though, if somebody does require care? What are we to do with them? Do we put them in a room where they can calm down? But obviously, people do need urgent medical attention as well. Something a bit different now to healthcare. So we know that new speed limits have been rolled out right across the country, but it's been revealed that the cost of new speed limits in the Letterkenny Milford Municipal District has come to a total of €136,218. I'm joined now by Councillor Declan Meehan. Councillor Meehan, this is a huge cost.
It is a huge cost. And look, I suppose anything that we think will actually slow people down and change behaviours and prevent collisions and ultimately deaths and injuries on our roads would be a welcome one. But this decision that was taken last year by the former Minister for Transport to push through legislation to decrease the speed limits wholesale across our roads, or for most of our roads, you know, it's not necessarily a bad policy, but what we've seen is a huge amount of money being spent on signage, and indeed a further €1 million across County Donegal has been earmarked for the other speed limit reductions that are to come into force over the course of 2025. And I just think that, you know, an awful lot of this money could be spent on measures that will actually change behaviours and slow cars down in areas where that needs to happen, outside schools that don't have traffic calming measures, in our towns and villages, which are constantly crying out for traffic calming measures and to slow cars down. So it's an awful lot of money that has been spent on this. You know, as an example of this, Michaela, I had requested previously a speed survey and road safety audit outside Carrickhill National School. This is just one example. And what that showed was that the average speed of a car going past Carrickhill National School in a 50-kilometre-an-hour zone was almost 70 kilometres an hour. So speed limits in and of themselves are not effective. If we don't have measures to enforce those speed limits, some people will always ignore them. And so what we need to see is money actually being put into enforcement and money being put into measures that will actually slow cars down, which we've seen in other villages and towns and other areas. A really good example of that would be Newton Cunningham, which has a number of speed tables installed throughout the whole length of the village and has been extremely effective in controlling the speed of vehicles going through that town. So it's projects and investments like that that we need to see, rather than brushstrokes, as which happened with this legislation, which may not really have any effect if it's not going to be enforced.
Yeah, do you think, although this was planned, do you think that it was a quick fix? Having attended council meetings, you know, numerous councillors have always called for traffic calming measures, and the response is always, you know, we need to carry out a survey, you know, the works could take 2 years to complete, but then they've reduced the speed limits now. But as you say, the argument is and always has been that this will not deter people from speeding.
No, and look, I mean, the evidence shows that any speed survey that takes place at the request of a councillor, for example, you know, 99% of the time shows that the average speed in those speed limit zones is much higher than the speed limit itself. I think that this was a reaction from government, and it's important to stress, I suppose, that this came from the Department of Transport in Dublin as a decision across the country. It was a decision by government to be seen to be doing something to react to the increasing numbers of road deaths across the country. You know, we have far too many road deaths. Speed is an issue on that, but enforcement is the thing that's lacking here. We don't have enough Gardaí on our roads, and we don't have enough traffic calming measures in areas where speed is a problem.
Do you think that there could be more speed cameras? I know we have the new one there between Manor Cunningham and Newton Cunningham, but do you think that, you know, by reducing these speed limits, that, as you say, greater enforcement does need to be implemented? But people, there is a fear around speed cameras. So if there was more erected, that people would adhere to the speed limits. I know you say we need more Gardaí in the ground as well, but that speed camera does instill a bit of fear in motorists.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I know people don't like speed cameras, or some people don't like speed cameras because they don't like getting fined and they don't like getting caught. But the message here is don't speed. That's the bottom line. Speeding causes risk to life. That's the long and short of it. And I think that any infrastructure that we can put in place that incentivizes people to adhere to the speed limits and to drive more safely is absolutely necessary. And I would like to see more of that infrastructure in place across the county, 100%. You know, in terms of our static speed cameras, they're few and far between across the county, but they are effective. And anything that's effective, I believe, should be invested in. And things that aren't proven to be effective, such as new speed limit signage, I think, you know, shouldn't necessarily have the amount of investment that has been given to this project. We need to see more speed tables. We need to see more ramps and built up areas and outside schools, as I've highlighted, and absolutely more speed cameras.
And do you believe that, we just touched on there, the length of time it takes to roll out traffic calming measures, do you believe that this could be done a lot quicker?
I think it could be done an awful lot quicker. And one of the huge issues that caused those delays is the funding model that we have in this country for speed safety measures. County councils have very little autonomy in being able to fund the speed restriction and traffic calming measures that they want to. And they have to apply almost on a case-by-case basis to the Department of Transport for funding to do that. And that's what holds up the installation of ramps or traffic calming measures in our towns and villages across the county. And giving more of a discretionary grant to county councils to be able to respond to problem areas, I think, is the best way and best case scenario for funding that going forward. And that would significantly reduce the wait times for interventions where there are problems.
And obviously that €136,000 in the Letterkenny Milford Municipal District that has gone towards these new speed limit signs, that signs that wouldn't go all the way, but it would go a long way in implementing these.
Look, absolutely. I mean, even if that was only to address one or two accident black spot areas or areas where we know that there is a high volume of cars speeding, particularly in built-up areas, I think that that's a much more worthy investment. And as I say, it's not that I think that reducing speed limits is a bad idea wholesale. I think that that is a welcome development. You know, some of the roads that are now 60 kilometre an hour zone are not fit for anything more than that because of the condition of the road, the width of the road, etc. But it is about putting money into what will actually be effective, which is measures and infrastructure and enforcement that will slow people down.
Councillor Meehan, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Yeah, that is an awful lot of money. And by the time you spread that out around the county, you know, it's could go a long way in installing traffic calming measures. I know the ones that Councillor Meehan referenced in Newton Cunningham, that does definitely slow down the traffic there. A couple of comments coming in. Imagine the cost of these speed reduction measures nationwide. It will be well into the millions. And to be honest, it's not going to work in my opinion. I was on an 80 kilometre per hour road the other day and someone passed me approaching a corner at well over 100 kilometres per hour. I was doing 80 and this lady in a BMW Jeep made me look like I was standing still. She was flying. Speed limits don't apply to people like that, it appears. How can these poles cost this amount of money? It's just a metal pole with a bit of cement. I suppose it goes into the design. Well, that would be a once-off payment, I suppose, the design of it. But yeah, their metal structures and the signs themselves are metal as well. Another listener says, the answer to speeding, put limiters in cars. Yeah, I am one of those that I do have a fear of being caught speeding. So I would put on my cruise control. I think that's, I'm throwing myself under the bus here saying I think it's cruise control. But yeah, to try and stick to the speed limit just simply because I don't want to pay a speeding ticket. But yeah, that is a serious amount of money.
Watch the show live now on YouTube, Facebook and at highlandradio.com.
Now, many of you have been getting in touch with regards the ambulance service managers and their vehicles now being treated as a benefit in kind. So we've got an email in, says a concern is that the ambulance managers now have to park these personally issued vehicles at a secure central location rather than at their own homes, which may lead to a delay in responding to the public out of hours. However, years ago, the National Ambulance Service established a scheme called Out of Hours Responder Scheme. The NAS encouraged and still encourages frontline ambulance staff to volunteer to use their own vehicles when off duty, using equipment supplied by the NAS to respond to and assist members of the public in their time of need. A message is sent to the personal phones if assistance is required. If available, they then respond directly to the scene in their own private vehicles from wherever they are to provide care and treatment until an emergency arrives. Indeed, at times, these same off-duty responders then travel to the emergency ambulance, to the emergency department, to continue the care and treatment of the patient and or assist the duty crew. These staff are to be commended for their dedication to the public even when off-duty. I believe as an interim measure, the managers affected by the benefit in kind ruling could volunteer to participate in this well-established scheme. This scheme removes the requirement to drive to a central location to pick up an ambulance service car, saving valuable time in the process. The National Ambulance Service also assists the public in the setting up of community responder schemes. This is where members of the public, having been given medical responder training, travel to certain call-outs in their locality using their own vehicles to care and treat until the arrival of NAS resources. These civilian responders absolutely deserve our respect and thanks. Hope these comments seem reasonable and help the greater good. What's your view on that? Let us know on 086 60 25000 or call us on 074 91 25000. We were talking there just before the ad break about speed limit signs and the cost of them. I'm joined now by Vincent. Good morning, Vincent. Not Vincent isn't there. We might get back to Vincent. So we'll move now to, as part of Global Congenital Heart Disease Awareness Month, which is February, the charity Heart Children will host its annual The Beat Goes On conference in Dublin this Saturday. Joined now by Sheila Campbell. She is the CEO of Heart Children. Good morning to you, Sheila.
Good morning, Michaela.
And Christine Callaghan is a mum to Aaron from Dunlow, who was born with a congenital heart condition. Good morning also, Christine.
Good morning.
So we'll start with yourself, Sheila. What is a congenital heart disease?
Well, the very simple way to understand what causes it is, as the child is developing in the mother's womb, the heart does not develop correctly. So the structural issues when the child is born are affecting blood flow in the body. So that's basically what congenital heart defects are. But saying that, there is a wide range. There's over 40 different types of structural issues in the heart, and some children can have multiples of those conditions, which, you know, would really signify that they would have the more complex forms of CHD. So many of your listeners may have heard of children having holes in their heart, and many of them are quite simply repaired. But there are a cohort of children born with congenital heart disease who have very, very complex needs and will require multiple surgeries and medical interventions and appointments probably for the rest of their lives.
And how many children does this affect?
Well, another thing to say is that congenital heart disease is the number one global congenital defect. So that's more than, you know, Down syndrome or cleft palate, that things would, people would, you know, recognise as being, defects at birth. But congenital heart disease worldwide, one in every 100 children is born with a heart defect, and that translates into 500 to 600 children in Ireland born with congenital heart defects.
And is this something that is easily identified, or there will be an incident where it is identified afterwards?
Well, there's two scenarios. Because of advances in scanning, medical scanning, about 70% of all children are diagnosed at the 20-week scan. So that means that there's lots of time for the medical team and for the parents to adjust to, you know, the birth of a child that's going to have the condition. But sometimes those scans are unable to pick up the heart defects, maybe because the baby's arm is in front of the heart when the scan is going ahead. So there are that other 30% then who are diagnosed at birth or shortly afterwards. Sometimes it can go undetected and it can be picked up at a later point. But importantly, you know, as I said, medical advances are now able to pick up 70% of children very, very early on in pregnancy, so there's plenty of time to prepare for their delivery.
Christine, did you discover that your daughter had a congenital heart disease during a scan?
Yes. So Aaron is a twin, and she's identical twins. So we were getting a lot of scans anyway, but it was picked up by the amazing ultrasound team in Letterkenny Hospital. Picked it up at the 20-week scan that Aaron's heart just wasn't quite right.
So then from the birth of Aaron, what has your journey been like?
A roller coaster of events, really. So just given the complications of the pregnancy with Aaron and then the fact that they were identical twins, they were delivered, you know, quite early at 33 weeks, and we delivered them in the National Maternity Hospital in Hollow Street. So it was a long journey, especially for the first year. We were pretty much residents of Dublin for that first year of Aaron's life. And yeah, it's been crazy.
And during the pregnancy, once you found out, how was that? Did it make it more difficult for you?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah. So it was a kind of tag team effort then between Letterkenny Hospital and the National Maternity Hospital in Dublin. So it was week on, week off from 20 weeks onwards until, you know, maybe for about till 28 weeks. We would go to Letterkenny Hospital 1 week, Hollow Street the next. And then from 30 weeks or 28 weeks onwards, then we were in Hollow Street every week for a check on the babies.
Yeah. And what age is Aaron now, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, so Aaron will be 5 on her birthday now in June.
And how is she now? Does she receive continuous treatment or is it something she lives with and you just keep an eye on?
We live with it. So she was born with a coartation of the aorta, which is a narrowing of the main artery in the heart. Now, when she was born, just given that she was premature, we had to wait a long, long time before she could actually get her first surgery so she could make weight. So that was repaired 2 to 3 months after she was born. And then she had open heart surgery then just before her first birthday. And then as a result of that open heart surgery, she has a complete cardiac block. So her heart doesn't beat on its own. So she is 100% reliant on a pacemaker to do all the work for her heart. So the heart has its own electrical system per se, and just in the repairs of everything that was wrong with her heart, that electrical system was damaged, so she doesn't have a heartbeat of her own anymore. So she's completely reliant on that pacemaker, which means then that we are up and down to Dublin on the regular. Mm. So it's at the very start, like, we never got discharged from Crumlin until the day of her first birthday. And then we now are up in Dublin every few weeks. So we get it, or every few months, sorry, we're a check in Crumlin Hospital now is where our care is.
And what was that impact, spending so much time in hospital, on your family? You had another newborn child as well.
Yes, it was a crazy time. So flying up and down from Donegal to Dublin, trying to be kind of splitting a bit of time between Dublin and home. Thankfully, Cove, her twin, is totally healthy and totally fine, so she could come home after 2 weeks. So then Cove was at home and Aaron was in Dublin, so there was a lot of logistics going on, trying to split the time, you know, as best possible. But of course, Aaron being the sick child, you know, the priority did lie with her for, you know, the first few years of her life, for sure.
And how is she herself? Is it something that she is conscious of?
She is very aware that she has batteries in her tummy that keep her alive. So that's what we refer to her box, or her pacemakers located in her stomach because she's so small. So she's very aware that she has batteries in her tummy. And as a result of that, because there's such a risk around, you know, maybe the pacemaker being damaged or the lead, then so we do. She gets a lot of care taken after her. She's kind of wrapped up in cotton wool. But she is also the same child who's very outgoing and very resilient. And she's probably the biggest risk taker in her whole family. you know, she really does. She does push it. Yeah.
And Sheila, back to yourself. What are the implications of congenital heart disease as a child ages and grows into an adult?
Well, I guess, you know, what we... Well, my direct connection with Christine would have been, you know, to provide play therapy, not for Aaron, who has CHD, but to provide some support for Cove. Because we would say that when there's a child with CHD in the family, everybody feels the impact. Mm-hmm. And so for her children, what we try to do is provide holistic supports for the whole family unit and for the person with CHD, but in the knowledge that the support that the person with CHD gets has to come from mum and dad, and they have to be in the right place to be able to offer the right care, and they need to be minded also. So some of the supports that we're providing are around psychological support, because, you know, it can be hugely traumatic for mum and dad to go through the whole experience of a child undergoing open heart surgery and not knowing, you know, the outcomes. Obviously, there is small risk involved in it. The recovery then can sometimes be difficult. So there can be a big impact there as well. And then obviously, you know, it impacts on the way, you know, your family continues to develop, you know. And then for the child whose mum and dad are missing and gone possibly from time to time because they're with the other sibling who's in a hospital for a period, that too can lead to them having separation anxiety and, you know, fearfulness and sort of watchfulness and anxiety to see if mum and dad are going and where they're going and when will they be back. So the other thing that we provide and we've begun to do is provide play therapy for children around the country close to home. So it's completely free of charge, and we set up a system with somebody close to home and provide 14 sessions of play therapy. And interestingly, we're doing it equally as much for children with CHD as we are for their siblings. So clearly the need is great for support for you know, the other children that are in the family unit. Yeah. But as children grow on into adulthood, I mean, most children are having the same life as other children. But they're not in any way different, really. Mm-hmm. But obviously, as Christine mentioned, where there is a child with CHD, they probably are minded and taken care of that little bit more, because of the inherent kind of danger that they have if they have something like a pacemaker. And so, you know, contact sports would be a complete no-no for children, you know, particularly with the pacemaker, but for any child with a heart condition, you know, one knock could seriously impact them. Although, you know, that's not to say they can't take part in lots of other sports where there isn't that risk, you know, of impact. You know, but most children are going, you know, going to school, doing what everybody else is doing. They might have extended periods away from school if they're in hospital, but, you know, leading normal lives like everybody else. And I think that's important to say, that that's one of the things we'd be trying to do, is try and make life as normal, give these children the confidence that they need just to live life to the fullest, just like any other child, really. Yeah. But, you know, in the knowledge that they are living a life with a condition that's there for life.
Because I'm sure there is a lot of fear among parents who find out that their child has this congenital heart condition. And it is important that, you know, they try and live their life as normal as possible, as you said.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I mean, we have fantastic medical care here in Ireland. You know, it's the holistic 360 care when people go home. That's where we're stepping in to try and provide services to make sure that everybody's given the support that they need when they're back at home, back trying to get their kids back to school, and they're getting back to work themselves, so that everybody is in the right place to make it all move forward positively. But yeah, there's no reason why any person with congenital heart disease can't do exactly what the person without congenital heart disease can do, you know. So it's just that, really, like, what our goal is to do is to make people aware of the fact that it is, you know, it is really a serious condition. Three times as many children are born every year as receive a cancer diagnosis in childhood. You know, whereas everybody would understand what cancer is, there might be lots of people out there who might be hearing about congenital heart disease in this interview for the first time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just to recognise that it's something that the child is born with, the child will have to deal with through their childhood and adulthood and for the rest of their life. And in some ways, it will obviously restrict them. And as people get older, you know, there can be issues for adults with CHD later in life in terms of getting life assurance or getting, in some cases, if they have very complex CHD, even a driving license. So at a later stage in life, it can have big impacts in you as well. But obviously, lots of people out there, I'm sure, listening are doing, you know, at work, you know, married, having children, having mortgages. So, you know, there are for some that is restrictive, but for others, it's just the same as everybody else.
And Christine, how important was that support for you personally as a parent?
Very much so. So Cove is Aaron's twin sister, and I feel like Aaron took everything that she's went through very much in her stride, whereas Cove was they're twins, they have a very close bond. So Cove does worry a lot for her sister. And that like kind of anxiousness or that anxiety has, you know, it has followed her through. So the making use of the play therapy for Cove is great.
Yeah.
It is really helping.
Yeah, and it's so important to have that. Your priority and your primary focus is obviously on ARM, but there's so many people, as has been outlined already, that are at the centre of this and going on the journey together.
Oh, absolutely. Like, we're a whole, our immediate and our extended family were impacted, you know, from our, you know, late night journeys, you know, to Dublin and having to get, you know, grannies involved and moving into the house for, you know, weeks at a time to look after the rest of the children while we were gone. And, you know, it clearly did. It had an effect on everybody involved. But then it was only after, you know, Cove started coming up a little bit that you realise, you know, she's very in tune with what is going on with Aaron, and the fact that, like, Mammy and she goes to bed some nights and she wakes up in the morning and Mammy and Daddy and Aaron are gone. And although it might just be for a routine checkup and nothing, you know, sinister or serious, but, you know, we're gone and she doesn't know, are we coming back or when are we coming back? And so she does, God love her, she does worry for Aaron. She's a great twin sister, and she's very empathetic, and she is Aaron's number one bodyguard, for the want of a better word.
Brilliant.
For her. But she, you know, but she takes on a lot, and she does take on a lot of worry for her. So we're hoping that the play therapy will let her, you know, just, you know, enjoy her own 4-year-old little life as much as Aaron is enjoying hers.
Yeah, and that is so important. So Sheila, the Beat Goes On conference in Dublin this Saturday. I assume anybody who has been affected can come along.
Yeah, we're running 3 streams. So a stream for adolescents with congenital heart disease, one for adults with congenital heart disease, and one for parents. And there'll be, you know, different kind of sessions for each stream. And anybody who's in either, it falls into any of those 3 categories is more than welcome to come along. It's free, and it's on in the offices of the Chartered Accountancy Ireland in Pearse Street in Dublin 2 from 9:30 till 3 o'clock on Saturday, this coming Saturday, the 22nd of February. And if anybody's interested in attending, they can register on our website at www.heartchildren.ie.
Great. Thank you both, Sheila and Christine, for joining me this morning. Now, in a bid to raise awareness of Lyme disease, a group of students from the Rosses Community School in Dunloe embarked on a Young Social Innovators project. 2 of them join me in studio now. They are Maeve Cannon and James Doyle. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, tell me, how did you get started on this?
Well, basically, you know, anytime, just living in such a rural area, anytime you'd be during the summer out to training, out for a walk, you'd come home and you'd be covered in ticks.
And when you're out walking your dogs and the cats and stuff are outside, they often come back covered in ticks, and it's important to be aware of that.
And I suppose it's so important. I had mentioned that I have a dog, so I'm kind of aware of the ticks through that, but it is so important, the impact that it can have on humans.
It is, yeah. People don't realise it, but it's a serious, life-changing, debilitating disease. It can kill you in the most severe cases, but it's really a chronic illness.
Yeah.
So, James, have you had any personal experience with Lyme disease or being bitten by a tick?
No, I have not had. I have been bitten by a tick several times, but I've never had this fear of being contracting Lyme disease.
Yeah.
Thank God. But yes, I have been bitten by ticks many times.
And I suppose that the aim of this project then is to make it easier, if you are bitten by a tick, to get the tick out.
Yes, and to spread awareness about the diseases they carry. So if you are bitten by a tick, you are aware of the dangers.
Yeah. So, Maeve, tell us about this Tic Tac Go.
So, Tic Tac Go, our main aims are to educate about the effects of Lyme disease, how serious it can be. Also, we have curriculums and lesson plans for national schools just to educate about ticks. But our main focus is creating our tick removal kits, which have everything you need, along with an instructional business card that we designed explaining exactly how to remove a tick.
So I can see it there in front of you. It's a lovely plastic box and it has, you know, the everything, as you say, in it. So how does somebody use this? Is it difficult to use or it is user-friendly?
It's very user-friendly. We have a step-by-step instruction along with what not to do. So there's an alcohol pad, just clean the area of wherever the tick is. And then there's two different types of tweezers, if it's really in deep, depending on which type you prefer. And then we have three different sizes of tick removers, depending on the size of the tick. It's just whichever is easier for you to use yourself.
So, James, how long did it take you to develop this?
It took us a couple of months, maybe one or two, to research and find out what we need to have in the kits. And then we spent probably another month looking into the best suppliers for our product.
Mm-hmm.
And then ordering them and putting it together, it took a couple of weeks or yeah.
And I'm sure that was a difficult thing to do as well, trying to determine exactly how robust it needed to be and things like that.
Yes, it was very hard. Like, we have got in contact with local pharmacies and stuff for advice and
And our local doctors, surgeries have said that there's so many people, they get so many calls about people wondering how much danger they're in by being bitten by a tick. And our idea was that if you're out for a walk or something or a hike and you've got one of these in your bag, you don't need to worry about Googling, you know, symptoms or Googling how to remove a tick, or even if you just have it at home and it's thrown in the shelf with all the medicines, that it can, you know where it is and you can use it if you need to.
Because, Maeve, time really is of the essence of this. You know, once you're bit by a tick, you need to get it out. And it's important that you get the whole thing out because it's so easy to just pull off one end of it.
Yeah, that's why we really advise against just doing it with your fingers, because if you do it with your fingers, you're probably only going to remove the body. But if you remove the head, then that still has the disease and the infection risk. Not every tick has it, but, you know, you wouldn't want to take the risk.
No, definitely not. And James, do you believe there should be more awareness of this in schools?
Yes, I do believe it should be discussed more in schools, because a lot of people who are out at Gaelic training or football training or even just out walking can get Lyme disease, and it affects you no matter what age it is.
And particularly living in rural Donegal, you know, it is so common here, unfortunately, that Maeve, you do need to be aware and be aware of the signs and what you are looking out for.
Yeah, so the main things you're looking out for is a bullseye rash around the area, but you don't always get a bullseye rash. The lesser symptoms would be like kind of being a bit fluey, having a temperature, just kind of normal stuff. But then if it progresses, go and see a doctor straight away if you experience any of that. But if it progresses, you can get arthritis, Bell's palsy, your face can become paralysed, irregular heart rhythms and neurological conditions, and it's mostly misdiagnosed. There's a lot of people who have it and don't know they have it at all.
So, James, anybody that's interested in this, how can they get one of these kits?
They will be in local shops and businesses. We will have them in Dunluce, and we're hoping to get them into Glenveagh National Park. We will have them in doctor's offices and tourist information spots.
Great. And is this something Maeve, you've had to fundraise for? Or is it an ongoing campaign for yourselves?
So back in November, we did a bake sale. We were raised about €350, and that helped us get started with the tick kits. And we currently have 65 of them. And then during the week, just there on Tuesday, we had the YSI den where we raised another €500 to make more kits and we can sell them, generate more revenue and keep funding the project.
Yeah, well, fair play to you. Well done. It's a very important issue and I wish you both well now that this, I'm sure it will do extremely well for you, is that people get on board and hopefully that your aim to raise more awareness that people do get on board with that. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you very much.